Welcome to It's About Florida, a weekly discussion program tackling the key issues and topics of interest to our state. I'm Tremel Gomes. Florida's 2012 legislative session is in full swing, and to jumpstart the event, lawmakers gathered in a Florida house on Tuesday, January 10th, to receive Governor Rick Scott's second State of the State address. This year's theme, Let's Get to Work Together.
We're willing to give our all to make Florida absolutely the best place to live and raise a family.
We've assembled a few of the Capitol's premier reporters to take a closer listen to the governor's speech and what it will mean for the rest of this year's legislative session. Our chief legislative news producer, James Call, examines the governor's speech along with John Kennedy, a reporter with the Palm Beach Post who has covered more than 20 State of the State addresses, and Jim Saunders, a reporter with the News Service of Florida.
John Kennedy, reporter for the Palm Beach Post Capitol Bureau. You've covered more than 20 State of the State addresses.
Well, none of them really have a lot of poetry in them, it seems like. They're kind of functional. They sort of set the focus and the tone for the legislative session. They're largely a kickoff event by most governors, no matter who they are.
Jim Saunders of the News Service of Florida. Rick Scott is the fourth governor you've written about.
Yeah, the State of the State addresses are, to me, are largely ceremonial. I mean, there's a lot of flowers, a lot of applause, a lot of family members there, but it really just is sort of a ceremonial start to the session.
In your experience, what is the political purpose of the State of the State? What type of tool is it for a governor? Is it a tool for the governor?
Well, it's a little bit of a highlight reel to the previous year, the previous session, and a little bit of a look ahead. I think to a great extent it's a squandered opportunity by most of the governors. I think it really is a chance when people are sitting at the edge of their seats, proverbially, to listen to the governor really lay out his vision for the coming year. And in most cases, that vision is not so hot.
You know, Charlie Crist actually moved his State of the States to primetime, or at least early evening. He was hoping he'd catch an audience, and I'm not sure that necessarily worked in terms of laying out a vision for the state. But he tried to make it a real time to make a presentation to the state.
That said, John, what do you think of Governor Rick Scott's State of the State?
Well, I think the governor's layout of his accomplishments over the past year was fairly good in that he was able to highlight how the state is slowly dragging itself out of the recession and that there are some glimmers of recovery out there. He pointed out how the unemployment rate over the past year has gone from 12% when he took office to 10% now, which is a pretty significant gain. But, you know, it's funny because there was a Quinnipiac University poll that came out yesterday that basically says more than three-quarters of Floridians think that the economy is the same or worse than when Scott took office. So there is a disconnect there that the governor has to address. How well he did that yesterday is a question. I don't think his delivery – Scott is not a very good wordsmith. He is a private sector businessman is his roots, and you can tell that he revels in job creation and entrepreneurship. That seems to be something that you can really get a sense from him that he loves that. But when it comes to trying to sell his case politically, he really – that's a challenge for him. And I think in yesterday's address, it was somewhat halting. It was somewhat off track. He tried to ad lib a couple of times that did or did not work. And he's just not the most effective public speaker.
Your review, Jim?
I think going forward in the session, the very most important part of that speech was his insistence on spending an additional $1 billion on education, because they have major budget problems to deal with. And to come up with $1 billion to put into education has all kinds of implications. He has called for making dramatic cuts in hospital funding to pay for a lot of that, which has touched off the hospital community. But there's all kinds of other programs, particularly health and human services programs, that are ready for a fight because they're afraid they're going to get cut to fund his education initiative. The question, I think, going forward is whether he is going to hold firm on that and whether the legislature will find a way to come up with that money.
So Jim, you've identified a major problem that lawmakers need to wrestle with. There's a projected $2 billion budget shortfall. The governor wants to increase education spending by $1 billion. Therefore, there's a $3 billion shortfall elsewhere in the budget. To me, it seems that he had the opportunity to present his case on how to get there, but did you see a roadmap laid out?
I did not see one yesterday. I mean, he has laid out a plan earlier in his budget presentation to be able to try to get there. But like I said, it's going to create a lot of controversy if they actually do what he wants to do. You know, he did make clear, though, in that speech that he does not want to budge off of this $1 billion increase in education funding. And from a policy standpoint and from a as I said, going forward in the session, deal with real issues standpoint, to me, that's going to be really crucial throughout the session if he holds firm on that.
John, previous governors, would Charlie Crist, would Governor Crist or Governor Jeb Bush, given the opportunity, knowing that there's this major problem before the legislature, having everyone's attention on the first day of the opening session, do you think that they would have handled the situation differently in the sense of laying out a plan to close that $3 billion gap?
Well, they may have. But then again, I think a lot of these state of the states are more 10,000 feet with the view that these are the goals of the legislature. I don't think you want to, in these states of the state, really, really bring up the bad side of it. And that's going to be, you know, hospitals are going to get whacked hard if I achieve my goal, of which I'm just saying I cannot budge. That was a line from the governor's speech. I cannot budge off that $1 billion increase to education. That is a very high bar that he has set for the legislature. And indeed, as Jim points out, it's going to be really hard to achieve that. And for legislators, I think the idea of really gouging the amount of Medicaid payments going to hospitals is a very difficult one, because all those hospitals are in their backyards, they're in their communities, and those hospitals have various connections to these legislators that, you know, people like Jim and I and James yourself, who cover the legislature from Tallahassee and know a little bit about our home communities, you don't always know the ins and outs of those kind of bonds that exist between legislators and you know, some of their hospital officials locally. So I don't think they're going to turn around and say, "Hey, I'm sorry, we got to cut your spending by 40%, which is what this amounts to."
Hospitals are major employers in communities, and particularly nonprofit hospitals have community leaders on their boards who do fundraising for them, who help run the hospitals, and quite often they're very influential in communities. And like John said, or as John alluded to, if they try to make major cuts in hospital funding, there's going to be a lot of those community leaders probably on the phone with legislators saying, "We need your help here." And that creates a real problem if that's where they're looking for funding for education.
So if they look for another target, that would have been something maybe that the governor possibly could have laid out, because indeed in his State of the State, one thing he did do, I thought, was convey a expression that he was looking to work with the legislature. He was very conciliatory toward them, very much complimenting them on the achievements that had occurred in the past year, that he couldn't have done it without them, that type of spirit. And that's a little bit of a different Rick Scott from last year when he came in as a darling of the Tea Party and a candidate who had run as an outsider against the system.
At the same time, a couple quotes from the speech that struck me. One is, we're talking about the $3 billion shortfall in the budget outside of the education budget if spending for education for schools is increased by $1 billion.
My friends, the state of our state will continue to improve. And what are those decisions we need to make to ensure these things happen? There are many. So I'd like to focus on what I believe are the three most important jobs I have as your governor. One, ensuring that Floridians are able to gain employment. Two, securing the right of every Floridian to a quality education. And three, keep the cost of living low so that the families and businesses that are in our state can continue to prosper and grow. And the ones that aren't here know they have to get here as soon as they can. When it comes to jobs, it's important to remind ourselves that private businesses create enduring jobs, not government. What government gives to one person necessarily had to be taken in the pocket of somebody else. There's something arrogant and overreaching in thinking we have the superior wisdom to micromanage an economy. Having spent decades in business, and now 1 year in government, I'm convinced more than ever that with few exceptions, the best thing government can do is to create a level playing field and then get out of the way.
The governor has put everyone in a box. He said what government gives to one person necessarily had to be taken from the pocket of someone else. That's a strong anti-tax message. Did either of you ever expect to hear words that harsh from a governor?
I don't think anybody at the Capitol thinks there's going to be any substantial or any tax increases. I mean, it's really been off the table for the past, you know, since Jeb Bush was elected and took office in 1999. There were a couple exceptions, one of which was a cigarette tax increase, and they increased a bunch of fees on driver's licenses and vehicle registrations and such. But really, it has been off the table and in a box for years. And I think Governor Scott is probably even more insistent on that than Governor Crist was. So it didn't surprise me at all.
What are the odds in an election year that the legislature makes $3 billion in cuts?
Well, I don't think they will perhaps have to go that far in that there's going to be some new economic estimates made this week on tax collections. And I think the general sense is that the economy is slightly improving, and that may allow the legislators to go into the session thinking they have to cut a little bit less. So I don't think you're going to quite see that level of reduction that's there. But you are going to see cuts. You're going to see – I mean, hospitals are going to get hit to some degree. Most of Medicaid spending in various ways will also get reduced. And where they're going to find those cuts is still a question mark. They're going to scale back all levels of state government, I imagine. And maybe that $1 billion doesn't turn out to be a billion with a B.
There's also other ways they can use to find money, and they take trust fund money, which is usually set aside for specific purposes, and shift it into programs like education. Or there's ways they can maneuver around without necessarily having to make flat out cuts.
Another quote from the governor's speech that struck me and seems to be in line with the Tea Party philosophy, but we're talking about the chief executive of the state.
Taxes and regulations, they are the great destroyers of capital and time for small businesses. Almost every dollar I earned as a shop owner went to growing our little donut shops. So every dollar taken in taxes slows the growth, and that impacts jobs. Almost every minute I had in the day also went toward growing our small business. So every minute I had to spend addressing some new rule or regulation also slowed growth. So when growth slows in small businesses, what happens? Jobs are the first casualties. So this session, we need to lower burdensome taxes on small businesses and continue our mission of slashing red tape in Florida. We must also improve the machinery by which government seekers, can get a job. I propose greater accountability for our workforce boards so that tax money is not wasted. And the purpose of those boards is fulfilled, to get people jobs. That's the entire purpose and the only purpose. I'm also asking you to require job training for those who are receiving unemployment checks. You know, I'm sure like in your life, in my life, every challenge creates an opportunity. And time in between jobs gives unemployed Floridians the opportunity to learn new skills. Now, while lowering taxes and eliminating unnecessary regulations are critical, the bedrock of any sound, sustainable economy is an educated workforce, well-equipped to meet the challenges of an advanced global marketplace. In my own life, I've seen firsthand how education puts the American dream within reach. As you know, I grew up poor. As a kid, I delivered newspapers for $5 a week. When I wasn't delivering newspapers, I was selling TV guides No one probably can remember that. For 4 cents profit a copy, and I flipped hamburgers for 85 cents an hour. Those are all jobs that I learned something in every one of those jobs. So today I stand before you privileged to be the governor of the greatest state in the greatest nation in the world. This is the American dream.
Taxes and regulations, they are the greatest destroyer of capital and time for small businesses. Any reaction to that statement?
Well, I think that is a real dog whistle to business owners across Florida. I think Rick Scott speaks their language. I think many Floridians, especially people that are involved with, you know, running their own shop in some capacity, feel that way. And Scott is from that world. So yeah, I mean, I think that's how he looks at all that, and I think he has a large audience out there in Florida that agrees with him.
There was a recent poll that showed his favorability ratings are very high among small business owners, and I think it's that sort of sentiment that appeals to small business people, you know, and so I think he has a real attraction in that way.
I mean, Scott has, you know, he has struggled for a year now with lousy poll numbers. I mean, he is not a well-liked governor, that's for sure. But I think he is liked in some quarters, and when he speaks those kind of words, I think those resonate with some, you know, sector of Floridians
and
out there.
I think that's why he keeps bringing up running a donut shop early in his life or his, you know, his business career, because there are people, or a lot of people in Florida who run small businesses and know what it's like to run a proverbial donut shop. And I think there's a connection there.
Now, you know, that's also an easy, you know, response for the governor to say, this is why the economy is lousy. You know, it's because of regulations and taxes. Is that the whole story? I don't think any of us really believe that. But that's a good element to hold out there as I can address that as governor. And I'm fighting for you, the businessman.
This is It's About Florida. I'm Tramell Gomes. You're listening to our Reporters Roundtable with John Kennedy, a reporter for the Palm Beach Post, and Jim Saunders with the News Service of Florida. They're chatting with our chief legislative news producer, James Call, about the hot-button issues this session.
The governor proposes big cuts in Medicaid payments to hospitals to find more money for schools. Senate Democrats frame this as pitting school children against sick kids and seniors. Do you think the governor's proposal will get the votes needed to pass?
I don't know that it'll get the votes in its the form that he proposed it. But I do think that there will be significant cuts in Medicaid funding. I think hospitals will probably take some of it, maybe a large portion of it. I actually ran into a lobbyist yesterday who works on substance abuse and mental health issues, and she was worried because that part of Health and Human Services is worried they're going to get hit. So I think all of those types of programs, particularly Medicaid-funded health programs, are worried that they're in jeopardy. I don't know that it'll be in the exact form that the governor proposed, but that's not unusual that that would change during the legislative process either.
John, six straight years of budget shortfalls. At the same time, lawmakers keep enacting or implementing more tax cuts. How many times can you go back to that prescription of reducing taxations to grow the economy? It seems that Florida has been doing this since the Jeb Bush administration, and it does not deliver the results that the proponents promise. Am I missing something?
Well, I don't know if the state had built up a very large well of reserves for many years, and the first couple of years of these budget cuts, the kind of effect on state government and state services arguably was kind of minimal. You know, there were vacant positions cut in state government. There were trust funds tapped. It's remarkable that we still have these segregated trust funds for specific causes, because they have been draining trust funds for more than 6 years now. But there's still reserves built up there. And does it work to fire the economy? I don't know. Florida has been the beneficiary for many years of amazing growth, people flowing into Florida. And when people flow in, they usually bring some job-creating skills, and they also have been building homes. I mean, we had an economic bubble that has burst, but in the rise up to that, it drove an incredible amount of revenue into state government, and that allowed for a lot of tax breaks during the period of Jeb Bush and Charlie Crist, and now a little bit what's left into the Rick Scott era. But you know, there are many people who believe that you cut taxes, you cut regulations, and that will fire the economy. That will get free enterprise going. They're also trying to give out economic incentives to companies coming into the state. I don't know. Government is a driver of the economy, though, and as you shrink government, that has an effect on school boards and health services that do indeed hire people.
So the problem is we're talking about tax cuts and cutting regulations as a means to grow the economy. We've followed this economic policy for more than 16 years through the Bush and the Crist administration, and this is the economy we have. Now, this leads us to the proposal for destination resort casinos. Can a legislature, which has wrestled with budget shortfalls for six consecutive years in a state – with an unemployment rate of 10%, vote down a proposal that would generate more than $6 billion in investment in construction mm-hmm. in the state of Florida?
Yes, they can vote it down because there are so many different parties involved in this debate that it's going to be really hard to pass this bill. You have the Florida Chamber of Commerce leading a business coalition that's opposed to it. You have other business groups like Associated Industries of Florida who are in favor of it. You throw in law enforcement being opposed to it. You have religious groups being opposed to it. And you have the House, which historically has opposed most expansions of gambling, that you know sitting there waiting for whatever the Senate does on it. So I think that there's a real chance that it goes down.
John, at the last Senate Regulated Industries Committee meeting, the room was overflowing with lobbyists when they took up the Destination Casino Resort bill. The room was overflowing with lobbyists. We're talking $6 billion. Some people are saying it could create 100,000 jobs, some of them long-lasting. In this economic environment, do you think the legislature has the will to vote down the casino resort bill?
I think they do, absolutely. I think it's a dead duck for this legislative session despite all its glimmers, you know, that the amount of money that it can draw into the state. There's too many competing interests and too much money in play here. The Florida Chamber of Commerce, which is really doing the bidding of Walt Disney World, is one of the outspoken opponents of this. Associated Industries of Florida, which is very much tied to a lot of the building trades organizations, are in favor of the gambling expansion. And then, of course, you have sort of the moral social folks in the middle. The state house has a very large contingent of Central Florida legislators who typically are going to side with Disney in something like this. In opposition, and they also have a lot of religious conservatives who just don't like the idea of expanding gambling. Also, when you think about it, these three destination resorts that are being talked about are pretty much isolated in South Florida. If they come, they're going to probably come to Miami-Dade, Miami Beach specifically, and into the city of Miami as well. Maybe up to Palm Beach, possibly if it could work its way up the coast or to Broward County, and maybe Tampa Bay, maybe not. But by saying that, that is a pretty isolated area of economic activity when you think about it across the state of Florida. So there's a lot of reasons for legislators who don't live in those communities to say no. And there are reasons for those that do live in those communities to say no too, because they're following what they think local businesses are concerned about. Then throw into that mix the paramutual industry, which has been a long-standing force in Florida. It is a troubled industry. It is a dying industry that is relying largely on card rooms and slot machines that they can put in their facilities or whatever games they can have. They know that if you bring in these casinos, there's a limited amount of discretionary dollars that people are going to spend, and they're going to lose out. So if people wind up up going to these destination resorts. That's Disney's concern. So it's all about bucks. And you know, I just don't see it happening this year, especially – it's an election year too, wildly controversial.
The Senate sponsors have been doing everything they can to try to make the paramutual industry happy. But in doing that, it expands the amount of gambling that would go on. They have to increase the games and so on at the paramutual facilities. And if you do that, then you draw even more opposition from those who are just opposed to the whole concept of expanded gambling. So it could even make it a harder sell if they do make the paramutuals happy.
So the Destination Casino Resort Bill, a $2 billion budget shortfall, changes on Medicaid payments to hospitals will all unfold in a session where all the lawmakers are up for re-election and preoccupied with redistricting, the act of redrawing the boundaries for congressional and state house seats. You both have covered previous redistricting sessions. How does this all play out? What should we expect in the context of these highly controversial issues in a session dealing – a very political session dealing with redistricting?
I think legislators throughout the session will have one eye on district maps. You know, so whatever else happens, you know, politically or policy-wise, they're going to be pretty much dominated by how those district lines fall. And there is the possibility that these lines do have to meet court approval. So there's a possibility that they also come back in a special session after these 2 months of the regular session are done. So. It's early. You layer in another complexity this year is the two new constitutional amendments that guide redistricting that basically say that you should not be drawing district lines that help or hurt incumbents or help or hurt either of the political parties. That's in the eye of the beholder kind of standard. But legislators are working in that direction right now. So there's a lot of moving parts with redistricting.
Legislators do not know the details of every issue that comes before them. But you can almost guarantee they're going to know the details of the districts that they are in and the districts that are surrounding them and how it will affect their political careers or their parties. It is something that everybody's talking about in the hallways and it's going to be talking about for the next 60 days.
John Kennedy of the Palm Beach Post, any closing words?
Well, I think it's always a fantastic time whenever legislators come to town. It's a there's a lot of issues, a lot of the future of Florida in the air, and it's always a great thing to watch.
Jim Saunders, News Service of Florida.
Well, it's here we go. the legislative session is always just a whirlwind, and issues like redistricting and the budget, we may not really know the outcome of them until early March. And in fact, in redistricting, we may not know till after that.
Thank you both for your time.
Thank you, James.
Special thanks to our guests, John Kennedy with the Palm Beach Post, Jim Saunders with the News Service of Florida, and our very own chief legislative news producer, James Call. You've been listening to It's About Florida, a production of WFSU-FM. Our senior producer is Regan McCarthy with technical assistance provided by Taylor Cox. Please join us again next week for more discussions about the issues impacting our state. I'm Tramell Gomes.